Judiciary hearing committee are all members of the committee with exception of Representative Hayes and Representative Malone. Scheduled matters that interest before the committee today were the confirmation briefs of Lou Williams and Glenda Straub for the Board of Governors for Alaska Bar Association, and continued matters that have been continued Monday and Tuesday, or from Monday through Tuesday and again today, on Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 257, House Bill 362, House Concurrent Resolution 33, and House Concurrent Resolution 34. To begin with today, I'd like to take about the same brush on the two confirmation matters, Lou Williams and Glenda Straub, and again tell you that it's my intention not to act on these two, but to ask if you have any additional questions other than those that appear in the file before you. We members of the staff did call them and ask them the questions printed on the one page, and the answers are on the next page. I would direct your attention to the resume of Glenda Straub, particularly in the work history area, the education area, and the volunteer work. I don't mean to indicate anything other than those are her words on there. She's Croft for governor, Rody for Senate, Bryan for State House, Copper for governor, Sheffield for governor. That seems to be her qualifications for this board. This Representative Coxon probably has more personal knowledge of what this board consists of and what its real duties are aside from its published duties. Representative Coxon?
The only comment I'd make is that it's been a number of years of struggle that I had some small hand in trying to bring public members on to the Board of Governors. As you may know, the Board of Governors is no recent business.
Perhaps it's proper for me to ask you a question that maybe you want to answer, maybe you don't, but I've already asked this to a couple of the present Bar Association people. I had it asked. If an applicant to the bar, or before the bar, and maybe to your general knowledge, came before the bar and had a shadow on him such as the present Attorney General has, would he be allowed to be admitted to the bar in Alaska under the present rules?
That's obviously difficult to answer because of the number of different circumstances, but I could pull out the statute, but there are specific
statutes in your file.
Yeah, there are specific grounds for not admitting someone to the Bar Association or removing someone from the Bar Association. Probably the best example on a national scale was after Watergate. We found that a great number of lawyers in the White House were involved in Watergate, and since they were involved in activity that ultimately was proven to be illegal, the individual states where they were licensed to practice law, their licenses were removed. Those are separate proceedings, and a broad answer to your question is if somebody's ever proved to be guilty of a crime of moral turpitude, they can have their license taken away, and people have had their license taken away to practice. There is punishment short of that, public opprobrium or whatever you want to call it, public censure, other types of sentences. The answer is, should someone be proved guilty of a crime of moral turpitude, yes, they could have their license removed.
Well, I wasn't so much speaking about taking the license away so much as I was just trying to think if you were trying to be admitted, you know, would you be denied admission?
There is a public moral character investigation that occurs. Frankly, it's been so long since I've gone through that investigation, I don't recall the questions that are asked, but I think it's safe to say that based on the due process clause, that the questions would have to be, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Are you presently under indictment for a crime? Things like that. Suspicion by itself, I doubt, would be grounds for denying someone a license to practice law.
I think that explanation varies somewhat from the explanation I kind of got related to me from the actual members that serve on the bar, but it's fairly close. Representative Wicke?
I don't know anything about that. I don't have any comments about the shadow or sound attorney general or anyone else, but what's the role? I specifically recall a case of an attorney who altered some documents and to try and get out of a malpractice suit and had some legal concerns, and he also was suspended from practicing law for 5 years. Is that done by the bar? It seemed to me the Supreme Court had some role in that. What's the relationship between this body and
the Supreme Court makes the decision based on a recommendation of the bar, which, on the other hand, the recommendation is developed by a staff member who's part of the Bar Grievance Committee, which is a portion of a subcommittee of the Bar of the Board of Governors.
So they,
the ultimate decision is made by the staff.
Yeah, they don't specifically make the decision. But I assume it's pretty weighty, whatever they say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask Representative Fox one question. If you are a member of the bar,
they do. They are active. They are particularly active in the last year or so. They have finally hired, I think it's one full-time investigator that investigates specifically these type of charges. I think there's even a consideration of hiring a second one because there are a number of complaints that get filed about people. A lot of them are disputes about fees, but he got overcharged, but he didn't provide services, got paid anyway, that sort of thing. And I'd be happy to provide you the statistics, but yes, they're very active in investigating the complaints, resolving them one way or the other, either deciding the complaint is groundless or that it does, there is ground for a complaint and that they go forward. They're very aggressive at it now. They were a little bad in the past, I have to admit, but they're much better now. Again, it depends on the circumstances. Depends on the circumstances. Many cases, until, of course, the person is proven guilty of something, they're allowed to continue to practice. In particularly serious circumstances, there can be an agreement that the person agrees not to practice law pending an investigation. That's within the power of the board to do.
That being said, I'd like to put those two confirmation efforts in the same posture we did those yesterday. Representative Wicke?
I'd like to, for purposes of the committee, just say I do know Lou Williams well. Kind of bring the attention of the committee what I consider a strong background, both for the specific appointment, but also just for any appointment. He is an individual who has been appointed by literally every governor to serve the state in some capacity or another, with the exception of Miller, although he did continue to serve even during that period. served on the judicial council of the other areas associated with the with the practice of law, and I would consider him to be a very independent member, aside for the same reasons I think that Representative Clarkson was interested in having them serve on the board or have public members on the board. For example, I do know during discussions on the peremptory challenge of judges, he was the only member of the board who, I guess, followed the position of this committee as opposed to what the Bar Association. So even in that situation where attorneys were very adamant about it, I'm sorry, but he took the position which I guess was could be characterized as not necessarily falling in line with whatever the attorneys want. He was appointed by Governor Hammond earlier in the year and has served leading up to confirmation. Governor Sheffield withdrew all the appointments in that area and then reappointed him. So even though he is a new appointee of the board, he has had the period of service on there under which he did show independent judgment in my mind.
He seems well recommended. Even Senator Ray seems to like it. It appears that it's Senator Ray's appointment anyway by the letter, is there?
I would assume I would state there's no question he could stand his own appointment with Senator Ray, and even if Senator Ray opposed him, I suspect that he has been named outstanding Alaskan along with some other very distinguished Alaskan Citizen of the Year in Ketchikan, my nomination once.
Again, that being said, we'd like to cast those two nominations in the same posture as the three we got yesterday and continue to review them all week, and hopefully one day next week we'll consider them as a group and ask the committee for motions at that time. Now we'd like to move back to the continued matter, which is the substitute for Senate Bill 257 or 257, proposing it is the Senate judiciary version that we're concerned with. It's an act relating to standards of conduct for legislators and legislative employees and establishing a select committee on legislative ethics and providing for effective date. We've been waiting for a day or so for folks to journey and be with us from Anchorage, and we have Sherry Jacobus and Hope Nelson here today. And at this time, Sherry, if you'd like to take, or whichever one of you'd like, or perhaps even both, take the seat at the end of the table. Sherry, step. Since we are recording electronically, I need you to state your name for the record prior to making your statement on the subject.
Oh, certainly. My name is Sheree Jacobus. I represent the Free Committee from Anchorage, Alaska. It's an arm of the Anchorage Women's Club. As we've indicated to all the legislators in a number of pieces of correspondence, the Free Committee has been very active in the area of legislator ethics. For the last 2 years, we've been studying this and have come up with a number of positions. After looking at the most recent version of the bill, the one that was passed out of the Senate, we sent around to all the legislators, and each one of you have just received a copy of it. You should have received one also last week. Our recommendations for changes to that legislation. I'd like to say, to state for the record, however, that the Free Committee believes strongly that creation of new bodies, especially in this time of dwindling economic dwindling revenues, is unwise. However, with that in mind, let's go through the legislation so that we can see what really needs to be done to this legislation to at least make it palatable and workable. The first thing we need to do is on page 3, line 29 of page 4.
Which bill are we working?
This is the Senate bill version that was actually sent out, Senate Bill 257, Judiciary.
The committee substitute
for 257 by the Senate Judiciary Committee,
amended version?
Yes.
It's the only version we have is the amended version.
Yes, it is the amended version. Okay, page 3, line 29, and page 4, lines 1 through 7. After looking at this, we researched what the statute actually says with respect to what the state can do, what can it do as far as contracting. And while the words in there say, by competitive bidding under AS 3705230, if you go to that statute itself, competitive bidding is only one small part of that statute. It encompasses such things as air taxi services, sole source, fair traded items, things which the state has already determined do not need to be let by competitive bidding because there are sufficient protections for the state. We feel strongly that as a citizen legislature, one that only meets part-time and one that is only paid part-time, and in a state where the majority of the largest employer is actually the state, that it's unrealistic to confine legislators and their legislative aides to only being involved in competitively bid contracts. And we believe that the state regulations themselves are good protection for the state. And therefore, we suggest that you delete the requirement saying by competitive bidding, instead say pursuant to the statute as it actually exists. We also had another recommendation which was made because we were unclear as to why the language was put in there. If it was, if you go to line, let's see, starting in line 2 of page 4 and going through line 7, we had suggested that you drop out the language beginning is a standardized contract because we were unclear as to the reasoning behind that. Since that time, we have researched it and talked to some of the legislators who were involved in that, and we believe that it is appropriate language to be left in there and do not suggest dropping it out. Okay, if we can, again, on page 4, line 18, and this is in the part dealing with state loans, we believe really strongly that public officials, and especially a citizen legislature like we have, really deserve to know what they can and cannot do before they become a legislator, and not to find out after the fact. So we suggest that that you have a statement placed in there that requires this committee to issue a list of loans that are considered to not create conflicts of interest. We think that's only fair. And so we said that within 30 days, the committee shall issue a list of loans that are not considered to create a conflict of interest. Such list shall be reviewed annually. We suggest that strongly because, again, we feel that as a citizen legislature, you have, and your legislative aides, and we have to remember this bill does affect them also, that you do have a right to use many of the loan programs that are currently in the state and currently offered by the state. And with that in mind, we feel that with having this list, that this will more fairly make you aware of what you can and cannot do. Now, when we get to the rest of this part on state loans, specifically if you look at lines 27 through 29 and lines 1 through 3 on page 5, it's at lines 27, 29 on page 4 and lines 1 through 3 on page 5. The way this is written right now, it actually requires that such things as, at least our reading of it and the way it's written here, is that such things as your any kind of supporting documents that you might give to a lending agency in order to receive a loan would actually could be made public, or at least could be reviewed by the committee. We believe strongly that while the public has a right to know, and that's an important component here, it is also important that legislators and legislative employees have a certain right to privacy and do not believe that the supporting documents that may very well contain very confidential information should be made part of the public record. We believe strongly that it is not the role of the Ethics Committee or the legislature to second guess those lending agencies that actually lend money. Even in a court situation where an agency is exercising administrative authority, the courts very rarely will take and put and impose their own decision on that legislative agency. And we believe that, at least in this case, that the Legislative Ethics Committee should likewise refrain from second-guessing these lending agencies. The real key role of an ethics committee, if in fact that is what you intend to pass here, is to determine whether in fact there has been any improper behavior, not to determine whether or not your agencies are in fact doing their job. Because realistically, in order to determine that, you would actually have to look at all other loans that were issued by that agency if you're going to be fair. You couldn't just look at what has gone on with legislators or legislative employees. And so with that in mind, we believe that that instead of sending a copy of your application, which may include confidential information, you should send notice of your application for a loan. That notice should be incorporated in your financial disclosure statement. And along those lines, if in fact you decide to go with an ethics committee, and again, we're not endorsing that concept, but if in fact you decide to do that, we feel that that you have to treat both legislators and legislative employees equally, and therefore would suggest that there be a place for the legislative aides' notice of applications be kept on file.
Sherry, Representative Biscuit. Mary Ellen, you're talking about application. That specifies that on line 27.
Yes, we would suggest, instead of saying a copy of the application, we would suggest saying a notice of the application and dropping out copy.
Copy.
Yes. And we'd also suggest dropping out the language, all records relating to a state loan to a person to whom this chapter applies may be disclosed to the committee. We have several objections to that. First, as a lawyer, I object to any time where it says may. It seems to me to either shall or you shall not, but not may. And in addition, again, like we said, we feel that there are some strong overriding principles of privacy. You know, in the state, we have a constitutional provision that guarantees a person the right to privacy. And there are certain things that in these applications may very well be private information, therefore we do not believe it should be made public.
Representative Coxon?
Maybe this is getting too technical for you, but throughout the bill, the phrase is used, wherever it is, a person to whom this chapter applies. That's how it's worded throughout, which would include the staff member. In the section on state loans, I note that the reference throughout is legislator. But you don't propose changing that language.
But
I would say the effect would be to not have legislative staff or former legislators covered by this section, yet that's not what you said.
No, as a matter of fact, the section actually does not say that. If you look, it says at line 14 on page 4, it says it's not a conflict of interest for a person to whom this chapter applies to participate. And it goes on further.
Right. But look at on line 21.
This is determining whether conflict of interest exists with respect to, because a legislator may be in a position. But that, it doesn't have anything. Then it says,
well,
on line 20.
Review the adequacy of procedures for granting loans to legislators. And then on line 27, you're in fact proposing to insert the word legislator.
No, as a matter of fact, let me start over. 25 says, upon application for a state loan by a person to whom this chapter applies. So that section applies to all persons, including legislative aides. And just let me finish for a second. And then what we would do is we would divide up, we would say that a legislator shall send notice of the application as opposed to the lending agency. It makes no sense to us to impose another obligation on the lending agencies. It seems to us that it's just as simple for the person making application to, it's just a matter of procedure to send that. And then in addition, we would have added language that said, and let me read it, I'll just read it to you from our paper here. It says, if the legislator shall send a notice of the application to the APOC, which will incorporate the notice into the applicant's financial disclosure statement, if the applicant is required to file a disclosure statement, which all legislators are, or which will place the information in a legislative employee loan file, which is open to the public, if the applicant is not required to file a disclosure statement. So under the language we would propose, it would continue to apply to both. We felt that the original language was confusing, seemed to us not to treat both groups fairly.
But just to follow up, again, maybe a small point, but who then files the notice? You're saying the legislator has to file a notice on behalf of all of his or her employees?
No. notice of the application, the zone application.
Well, there's no method in here then, even with your amendments, for this, the legislative employee to file any notice. There's a method, you're proposing a method by which notice is publicized once you file it. And again, I have to go back to the language on lines 22 to 24 that says a committee has to consider the procedure for granting loans to legislators, but they don't have to review the procedure for granting loans to legislative staff.
So there are indicating language there in the last sentence probably of your amendment there. You said if an applicant is not required to file a disclosure statement.
Okay, I think that Representative Clarkson has brought up an important point. Perhaps instead of saying legislator, we should say the person
right,
to shall send.
To whom this chapter applies or whatever.
Well, they've already got that in your first part, so I think person, to make that clear. It's not our intent to make a distinction.
Okay, well, that's the main point. It's not your intent to make any distinction between staff and legislators, except to the extent that you have to do so because the staff is not filing disclosures.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, then on page 5, lines 4 through 9, and this is an important issue, I think. This particular section only deals with each state loan agency, which must deliver a listing of all outstanding loans to persons to whom this chapter applies, except for loans described, which are not conflicts of interest. We feel strongly that if, in fact, you're going to do this, and again, if you look at our previous stands, we're not really in favor of doing this, but if you're going to do it, it seems to us that the majority of state loans that are going to be subject to this chapter are going to be state loans that are not through state loan agencies themselves, but are actually through quasi-state loan agencies. For example, I guess they call it CFAP. I think in the telephone book they call themselves the Alaska Commercial and Fishing and Agricultural Bank. But it's basically a bank that was set up with with money from the legislature. And we don't believe that particular group should be excluded. So the language should be clarified so that because that's really going to be the kinds of loans you're going to be looking at. You're not going to be looking at state housing loans and things like that, because they really will fall out under Section A. And so we propose language, and again, this was somewhat arbitrary. You may, as a committee, decide to make it somewhat different, but we propose that instead of each state loan agencies, the words should say, on February 1, each lending agency that receives more than 50% of its funding from state funds. And they shall have to make these reports.
Representative Whitkey?
Right now, under present procedures, every legislator has to report any loan that he has in a given year, which would include a listing of state loan. Is anyone in the committee, I mean, Joe or one of the, isn't there a present process now that the documents and those loan files are public information? It seems to me there has been extensive.
There's been a listing released, yeah, I know, but not the applications.
Well, I know just any state loan is public information, and that there have been Attorney General's opinions that seems to me apply what's confidential, what's not.
There are Attorney General opinions that have decided that, in fact, the backup things that contain confidential information are subject to the privacy of that person and are not public information. And so they have decided before that they aren't public information, and we're proposing that legislators be treated no differently.
That they would remain private?
Yes.
Just to complete the point, the requirement starting on line 7 that the list must include the name of the person, date of issuance, and current status of the loan, that information is currently public.
Yes.
For legislators as well as any other person who's received those loans. That's a question.
I'm not sure whether it's public as to the status of the loan. I'm not positive about that one. But I do know that as far as legislators, it is public information whether in fact you have a loan. Checked to see whether or not we're not advocating this, to be honest with you. The only main point here is that we feel that since there are more state lending agencies out there than are called state lending agencies, that there should be some recognition that you do have these quasi-state lending lending agencies.
Here, Sam Clarkson.
You keep making the reference, something like, you're not in favor of this. What exactly is it, the this, in favor of releasing any information about loans, or that loans are prohibited, or?
I think I have to be very clear what I'm saying. The free committee is not necessarily in favor of the creation of more committees, more commissions. But assuming that this body decides that it must have a commission or a committee, these are the things that we're suggesting you do to this particular language. Okay, page 5 also, lines 10 through 14, there is a section, subsection E, and it deals with establishing separate regulations for granting and reviewing loans to persons to whom this chapter applies. Now, we feel strongly that regulations should be written for everyone, and that if the regulations are somehow remiss, they ought to be rewritten for everyone to make sure that the loan procedures are being followed. In addition, we'd like to point out that if in fact they do make new regulations that are somehow better for these people, then we question whether or not you even need to have an ethics committee to oversee it. It seems to me it's one or the other. Either you're going to live with what you have, make good regulations that apply to all the public to make sure that the public money is being loaned properly, or you don't need an ethics committee if you're going to have separate regulations for that. Okay, subsection F, which is the one following that on line 15. This actually requires the Division of Legislative Audit to annually review state loans granted to or held by persons to whom this chapter applies to determine, and this is the point that we have problems with, whether appropriate procedures were observed in granting or reviewing the loans. Now, as I said before, we do not believe that the role of the legislature the Division of Legislative Audit, is to second guess these other agencies. We believe strongly that the other agencies should be able to do their job. If they're not doing their job properly, then it should come to the attention generally and not just with respect to legislator loans. We'd like to point out that just the fact that somebody is a legislator and you look at their loan package and you see that maybe instead of requiring them 5 days, you gave them 4 days, does not indicate that legislator received any special treatment. It may be that the routine way in which that is handled within that agency is to only have four days. And so that the important point here is whether or not the agency is doing its job, and not to second guess whether on a particular loan package they did that. If there is a conflict of interest and someone's acted improperly, let a complaint be brought. Don't investigate each and every one. It's not necessary. We think that whole thing should actually be deleted as a result. In F, we suggest that you take out the language about appropriate procedures and instead say that to determine whether loan conditions imposed by the lending agency are being enforced. And that really is the more appropriate role for the legislative audit, to make sure they're not, in fact, ignoring conditions.
Thank you. As I understand your comments on that you're saying subsection E above that probably ought to be taken out.
Yes.
That probably ought to be taken out. But that legislative audit or whoever might be a good idea for them still to do a review of loans made by people, or loans granted to or held by people to whom this chapter applies. Still do a review of that and report its findings to this committee of ones established. But in looking at those transactions that the legislative auditor has assigned responsibility, would only determine whether the agency was following its own rules that apply across the board in making these specific loans.
Specific conditions they've placed in.
Representative
Biscuit? Yeah, I got a question on that one. Why would the what would be the difference on the legislative audit against a legislator applying for a loan or just have John Doe off the street out there? What's the difference?
brought up the question that, in fact, Free Committee has asked many times. You brought up the very question that Free Committee has asked itself. Why is there this big difference? You know, you already have laws on the books to deal with people who are acting improperly, and they should be by an affirmative complaint. We don't know whether you need to have a constant investigation ongoing, but assuming that's what you intend to do, we feel that at the very least you should not be reviewing how that loan was actually granted on an every single case basis. You know, if there's an improper behavior, let a complaint be brought. But if you are going to review anything, the most that you should be doing is reviewing perhaps how they are enforcing those conditions. For example, if the person's making late payments, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about conditions. Are they enforcing it? Or do we have someone sitting out there who has in fact not made no payments for 3 years? That's the most that we think you should be doing. We're not saying that you should be doing this. Okay, we also believe at the bottom of the page, starting at line 29, it's the section that deals with interest between public officials, and it goes to line 16 on page 6. We believe that entire section should be deleted, and let me explain why, because it's kind of complicated. We read this and we really couldn't understand why this was in here, because there's a total duplication of the process. If you look at it, it requires that you put in the journal on a daily basis, if necessary, any kind of financial an economic association between legislators, public officials who are required to have a financial disclosure statement, and a registered lobbyist. Now those are only three that I'll deal with first. There is also one other that deals with supervisor. We'll only talk about the first three. Those things are already covered by the APOC. You are already required to, on an annual basis, list any of your economic associations with these people. Why is it that we have to duplicate this process? Now, if we're talking about legislative aides, that is even another group, and yet they themselves, if they have a relationship with legislators, the legislator would have already disclosed it. If they have one with a public official who is already required to file with APOC, they would have already been disclosed. So there's no point here. Then you get back to the first subparagraph, which deals with a supervisor. The issue here, as we understand this bill, is legislative ethics. Now, the fact that you might have a relationship, an economic relationship with your supervisor, and obviously we're not talking about legislators here, we're talking about aides, to me has nothing to do with legislative ethics, and therefore is improper in this particular piece of legislation. We just feel that this is duplicative. We don't feel that it adds anything to the legislation, and it's just going to require a lot of paperwork.
I think what you're saying about this being the duplication of the APOC filings is correct as it applies to legislators. Can you elaborate on how it's correct as it applies to staff?
Okay, it's correct when it comes to staff, except in the part that deals with the supervisor. If you look at legislators, they will have already. It may not be the legislative aide who disclosed it, but the legislator would have already disclosed it. Again, with paragraph 3, the same thing applies to paragraph 4.
Well, for example, Mr. Chairman, under current law, as far as I know, a legislative aide has no requirement to disclose a financial relationship with a registered lobbyist who is not a member of the immediate family of the person.
But the lobbyist has that responsibility under the lobbying statute. It does require them to disclose their economic associations already, so you will have duplicated that. And I'm not sure how much that's going to add to the knowledge that you already have.
Representative Foxman?
And I assume the reasoning follows through on sub 3, a public official in another branch. If the public official is required to find
this section really only addresses people who are already covered by APOC, with the exception of a supervisor.
And in that, if I can continue, as I read the way this works, the circumstance where it would arise is where the supervisor would be a legislator.
It's sounds like that's what they're getting, but they don't really say that, because in fact you have legislative employees working for example, legislative information, legislative affairs, who will be affected by this, who have supervisors who are not legislators. And again, the question becomes, why is that relevant to the purpose of this particular bill? And I'm not sure, so sure that it is relevant. Okay, if we can go on, because we have a lot of comments here. Starting with line 17 on page 6. Now, I did not include this in our language, but looking at this, there are a couple problems with what happened here. They completely gutted the original legislation, the original bill that came out of legislative reform committee. We would suggest strongly that they go back to the original language, which more clearly defined what gifts were. As a matter of fact, this one really bothers me, because they say that you only have to, the only time you're in trouble for soliciting a gift is if the gift was intended as a reward for official action. It doesn't have anything to do with if it was, if you could infer that in fact it was in to get official action. It's only as a reward, which implies that we're talking about after the fact, which seems ludicrous to us. It's the original legislation as drafted by the Legislative Reform Committee was excellent. It made a very good attempt to define a very difficult area. You might want to play with some of the amounts, but that's about
The original language in Senate Bill 257.
Yes. It's also the original language in the House Bill. Coming down to line 26, the section dealing with nepotism, they have something that seems to be a little inconsistent. In the first part of it, of this section, they deal with the employment of a relative of a member of a legislature. And then in the second part, they deal with an individual who's related to an employee of the legislature. And the reason that that language is significant is they define the language in the last part of that subsection to include a member of the same household. We believe to be consistent that a legislator should be treated the same as a legislative employee in this case, and that the language on line 26 should instead say, an individual who is related to a member, so that the legislator is treated the same as the legislative aide.
Representative Phillips, if you
have a question.
Wait a minute. Can you hear him? For the record, can you state your name prior to
speaking? I can use Ron's. That's a good seat here. Representative Randy Phillips from House District 15. I wanted to stop there on page 7, and I know my staff has contacted you on page 7, line 5, members of the same household. It seems to me, you know, there's a household here in Juneau, which I have, and I have a household in Eagle River. Now, you care to comment on that? Let's put it that way.
Well, as Ms. Seitz and I talked on the telephone, we do recognize that a number of legislators do share households with various people, and that these do not necessarily have any kind of economic association. They just might be someone they're rooming with. If this, in fact, is the case, and if people are concerned about that, we would suggest that a letter of intent be drafted to go along with this legislation, so that you could have it clear as to what you were talking, that you're not talking about people who do not have an economic association. However, we believe strongly that in this modern day and age, and in the state of Alaska, where it is a very common and acceptable practice to share a living arrangement with a member of either the opposite or the same sex, that these people should be, in all fairness, should be treated the same as people who are also sharing a marital relationship, since they, in many ways, have the same attributes and could very well cause conflicts. There are many instances where those conflicts are real. And so we feel that if you're really going to go after the children, the wife, the husband of persons in the legislature, other types of relationships should also be addressed, and that's the reason for this.
Okay, then I guess what I'm getting at is that which household are you really after, the one here or the one in Eagle River or both?
I think course, I did not draft this.
Right,
this
I understand
committee.
That.
Okay.
I just wanted to know what the free committees.
The free committee actually had something quite different. Their original language had said that they share the same permit address, and or share. And I guess the other language you put in there is share a close economic association. We believe that in fairness, you should be addressing people who are in fact do have that economic association, whether it's 50-50 or 75-25 is really not relevant. But we really feel that as long as a spouse has to reveal.
That member of the same household was added by the Senate, so you might want to take a look at the original bill.
You know, yesterday Senator Kelly spoke about the original bill, and I presume he's talking about the preceding bill before this. And,
yeah.
And after the committee meeting, of course, the tone of it all changed, and he no longer wanted us to have the original bill up there. He just wants this one considered, so that's where we are now. Representative Clarkson.
Well, I have two questions on this section. One of them, I'm looking now at the original language, House Bill 362. The original language is apparently almost identical except for two differences. One of them is the household difference, and the other one is the change in line 26. Right? We don't have Senator Kelly here. I'd sure like to know why they would change that language to screw it up. I sort of agree with the witness that...
Representative Phillips, do you know?
What bill are we dealing with?
Well,
now?
He's taking
the House bill. It says an individual who is related to a member of the legislature. So that's, I just don't understand. You can't answer that, but I'd like to know that. The second question I have, again, doesn't relate to your language, but it's in the same section. As I read this nepotism thing, it would prohibit me from arranging to have my wife work in the House, but she could work in the Senate, but she could not work in the Senate during the interim.
That's correct.
And could somebody explain to me what the reasoning of that?
Representative,
say it one word, tradition. Basically, tradition in the past few years. Well, let's go back in history. Back in 74, we did have a problem with nepotism. There were quite a few relatives working in the same body in, I believe, 75. Check the records, it was there. The following year, the year after that, it was almost a complete prohibition of hiring any relative. But traditionally, by and large, there are some exceptions. If I had a relative who wanted to work, that person had to work over in the Senate or vice versa.
If I can continue on that, I understand the tradition.
Okay.
Whether or not it's a good idea is another question, but I understand the tradition. That's no explanation for why my wife could work in the Senate during the session, but not during the interim.
If you want, after I'm all finished, I'll take off my free committee hat and testify as to that, too, because I have strong feelings, but the free committee does not have a position on that one.
Well,
I didn't know that Representative Fox was going to get down that issue. I'd noted it.
It
doesn't
may
make
not
any
be
sense
appropriate
to me
either. The witness hasn't raised it, but I'd like to flag it for future discussion.
As soon as I finish this, I'll put on my other hat and talk about that because I have strong feelings about that issue. If you look at line 9 on page 7, this deals with representation. The original language that was in the bill originally is much better. Letter here, we have suggested changes, but we have one thing that was in the original bill that we don't really agree with, and that is that in the original bill they prevented somebody from avoiding a conflict by not receiving compensation, and we believe that is in a sense almost a violation of your right as a legislator to represent your constituents, and we are very concerned about that. We believe if you don't receive compensation of any kind, we do not see how that creates a conflict of interest for you. And for that reason, we would suggest that not be included. But the language, as as spelled out in our letter to you, is what we would suggest using, which is basically the language that was in the original legislative reform committee, the original language of the bill.
Maybe it's trying to read at the same time I listen. I lost you completely. I'm looking at the proposed language,
okay.
And that didn't seem to match up with what you said.
Okay.
You just shut up and listen this time. Try it again.
It's been a long day. Line 9 through line 17, they have a section in here which we would recommend taking out. It is suggested, it was amended language on the floor of the Senate. We would suggest instead using the language that was originally in the original legislation, SB 257, and also, I guess it's House Bill 362. The original language on representation to us is much better. And if you want, I can read that very quickly.
Well, I have it. It basically says, may not represent another person for compensation before an agency.
That's right. And the
if I'm a legislator, aren't I being compensated for representing a constituent?
Well, I think that is, I think, yes, you probably are receiving some compensation, but I also believe that whether you receive that compensation or not, whether or not you represented the constituent, you would receive the compensation. So in a sense, you're not receiving compensation for that particular person.
But that would apply to law firms on retainer as well.
Yes. Yes, it would.
So you think that's okay?
No. For representing a constituent?
No.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Same pay arrangement is there. I get the same monthly pay regardless of whether I help that constituent.
Okay,
but
I think
help
in that case, though, they are actually doing it for compensation from that particular person here. What we're trying to avoid is the problem of, for example, Representative Wendy having a constituent call him up and say, I'm having trouble with so-and-so. Could you call him and see why my loan papers have been held up? He's not receiving any compensation. It is, however, something that people do receive compensation for, and therefore may put him in violation of the original language that was in the original bill. We don't think that's right. We think that is your role as a representative. You should not be subject to the possibility of being having a complaint lodged against you because of that. This, the new language that's in here, it does not prevent you from doing any representation at all. It just makes you disclose it. And that is not typical throughout the country. Typically, they don't allow people to represent people for compensation.
Chairman,
Dave Lisker,
question on that one. I'm not an attorney, and I guess John over there has the upper hands. That is not in the law today. Representative Clarkson and Pettit are both in the House right now. They cannot represent clients while they're serving as legislators. You're changing this over here now where they can. Right?
They can represent. Under the current law, they can represent clients, and most of them, in fact, do. I had many cases against Chancey Kroc while he was in the legislature. The only thing was that they could not have a court hearing during the time in which the legislature was in session. But yes, they do represent clients, and there's nothing wrong. There's nothing unethical about it. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that. And this particular bill would not prevent them from continuing to have clients. It would only prevent them from, for compensation, representing those clients before the state in any manner, other than in a court proceeding.
Yeah. Well, I've got a question on that, Mr. Chairman. In the original legislation, and also rather in the original legislation, also this proposed rewrite of Senate Bill 257 amended, why give special dispensation to an effective attorney's wife?
Well, can I answer that? There are, first, I think it's a misconception that we're only talking about attorneys here. With respect to an action before a court of the state, obviously we are talking about attorneys, but with respect to those matters that are maybe pending, they may, in fact, be engineers, architects, public utility consultants represent their clients all the time. There are many, workman's comp, for example, you don't have to be a lawyer to represent somebody. So it's not just lawyers that we're talking about. And actually, this takes and changes the current status of the law and prevents them from representing, taking on new clients and representing them in equal state, any state agency.
Representative Lowe?
Well, I don't don't understand it. In other words, it would prevent an attorney from taking on a new client, as well as, say, an accountant that's representing utilities commission or something.
Unless the attorney was going to represent that person in an action before the court of the state, for example, a criminal matter. And that's the only time that he would be permitted to take on a new client in an action with the state.
Well, I want to stay on this a minute if we can. The comment by Representative Liska, let me try to figure out what the existing law is. Are you telling me that, is it permitted for me presently, I'm an attorney, to represent a client in front of the Alaska Transportation Commission?
Yes.
And receive compensation?
Yes.
I can do that.
There's nothing that prevents you right now from doing that.
Under your proposed change, which is sort of the original language, I would not be able to do that.
Not a new client,
I understand.
Right, somebody that was already pending at the time that you assumed office, you could continue. And that's to protect clients.
I could represent a constituent so long as I didn't ask for any compensation above and beyond what I received as a legislator. Well, I guess to go back to Representative Malone's example, in the section on contracts, the other relationship people have with the state agencies is by contract. I might do it as a representative, but an engineer might be doing it under a contract. The effect is the same, representing a client before a state agency to accomplish a purpose. And as I read the contract section, they would be allowed to do that.
Except that under this particular section, they would be prohibited.
That's right. That's an inconsistent standard for roughly the same representation. Engineer representing a client, lawyer representing a client. One of them happens to be a contract, so the contract section says it's okay.
But if you're talking about a contract, what happens, though, is it's a little bit different situation. Here we're talking about an actual representation where you take compensation to do that particular, just to do the representation itself. We're not talking about actually going out and doing an architectural design or something of that nature. We're talking about going and representing your client before a state agency. For example, in a public utilities commission hearing, an engineer, an architect, any of those people can go and represent a client before the public utilities commission or the transportation commission. And this would prevent them from doing that as a new client. They could not do that. Under the contract section, they could perform certain limited duties. Even those would be somewhat limited as to what they could do. They're allowed to get a contract under the contract provisions.
Okay,
well, I don't want to keep talking about it forever, but it seems to me pretty hard time maybe determining what the compensation is for. If you have, let's say, an accountant that has a client, if that accountant serving in the legislature, one of their clients happens to be somebody regulated by a state board of commissioners, a trucking company or something like that. So part of that contract, they have an agreement, they go and they represent, in effect, represent somebody state board and commission. Maybe they got a retainer, you know, and they say, well, I wasn't paid any extra compensation for this particular action, therefore I did that for free to keep from violating the law. Well, that, of course, would be a dodge, is what it would be. So I just think it's a difficult section of law to write.
I think you're right. I think you brought up really what is an essential issue in all these ethics legislation, and it's something I feel strongly about. If you have someone who's unethical, who's going to act improperly, they will find a way to act improperly. And they will manipulate no matter what you write. You're never going to be able to write it to attack every single situation. But the issue here, seems to me, is not just to get those people who will act improperly. Because like I said, they'll find a way around it. It's really to make sure that the law is not written so that you trip up the innocent. And that's the thing that I'm concerned. Like I said, we do have citizen legislators. We do not have legislators who work full-time at this. They have to make a living somehow, and as a result, it seems to me that you've got to take that into consideration. And it seems, I think the legislation has to be written so that it is fair, and that it fairly makes people, that it fairly apprises people of what may occur and what they can't do. I agree. Somebody could very easily do exactly what you're talking about and make it into an argument about whether it's in fact a retainer or whatever. But that's something that you're going to have to wrestle with anyway.
Not necessarily. If the section 2460-100 is in 257 and that fiduciary amended were adopted, that particular question would not arise, necessarily arise.
You mean that was passed out of the Senate?
Yeah, because you can just list all your clients or people like you do now under the public disclosure law, put it on this report.
Well, that certainly is a policy decision. This body has to decide whether or not they want to do that, in fact.
Representative Carson?
Two brief questions again on that section. First of all, would the effect of this be to prohibit any member of my law firm from also representing someone before an agency?
No.
For compensation?
As a matter of fact, it says only the member of the law. It says member. And I think that was written that way on purpose. So we only talk about the member itself.
Second question is, in the original bill, House Bill 362, there is a subsection C, which is noticeable from its by its absence from your proposal.
You specifically left it out.
Okay. Subsection C says a legislator cannot avoid a conflict of interest under this section by waiving compensation where compensation would ordinarily be expected. You think that I should be allowed to waive compensation in order to represent someone before an agency?
That's just to avoid the problems of constituency.
Yeah.
But again, you may decide not to do it. That's, again, a policy decision. How much do you want to limit yourself? Okay. The next issue we addressed is kind of it's one that we don't have strong feelings on because we're not sure exactly how you're going to want to handle this. It's on line 26. This really gets back to the main reason the Free Committee is concerned about this legislation. They do not want to see a cumbersome new bureaucracy created, such as a commission. And so with that in mind, we were trying to come up with ways that would limit the necessity for an ethics committee, the necessity for permanent staff, and permanent office space. And for that, we suggested that rather than the committee maintaining a public record, which would necessitate office space, staff, and all the other accoutrements that go with that, we suggested that that really the only time this committee needs to come into existence is when there's been a complaint filed. And for that reason, we suggested that the Rules Committee, and that was very arbitrary, the Rules Committee is an interim committee. It's my understanding anyway, it goes year-round. And so instead we decided that they would maintain the record open to the public for disclosure, just because that was a convenient place to put it. You could put it in legislative affairs or legislative information. Wherever it is that you want this public record where the person is supposed to disclose their conflicts during the interim. But we felt that this was one suggestion of the Rules Committee, but we really do not want to see a year-round ethics committee.
Representative Fox, and just before you comment, one of the things about putting in legislative affairs, of course, is you do have both bodies in one committee. If you go to a Rules Committee, you've got to have two Rules Committees.
Legislative Affairs or Legislative Council?
I mean, the Legislative Council is a bi-body body.
My question was just why the rewording of the public record language?
Okay. The reason for that is that if you look through the rest of the legislation, there is a provision which, and we're going to get to that in a minute, and it's very confusingly written, that does not allow decisions by the committee to be made public for 30 days, and those 30 days only run while in session. It was our understanding of reading this that the intent of this particular paragraph was to have an ongoing public record, and so we were trying to ensure that, in fact, that's what it clearly said. And there may be some other ways you can word that so that it's much more clear, but we weren't concerned about that. Okay. again deals with the contract, the ability to contract. Again, this our suggestion reflects our concern that we not create another bureaucracy. And for that, we decided that they would be limited to employing staff only when there is, in fact, a complaint to investigate. And for that reason, we suggested that the language be added that should say the committee or subcommittee may contract for professional services and may employ staff as it considers necessary to investigate a complaint and to recommend action by the legislature. The authority of the committee or subcommittee to contract for professional services or to employ staff is expressly limited to those times that it is actively addressing. We didn't see any necessity for an ongoing committee, and that's the reason for that language change. Let's see, page 9, lines 8 through 15. This deals with the advisory opinion. We feel strongly that if you do have a committee, then it's important that the committee not be bound by inaction. There are many reasons that a committee may not be able to have an opinion out within 30 days, and the mere fact they don't have an opinion out should not bind them. And for that reason, we felt that should not, the fact that they don't have an advisory opinion out should not bind them, and that should be changed. And we have language suggested in here that would do exactly that. Finally, on page 9, line 26, right now this has a proceeding maybe begun within 4 years. You know, it's pretty difficult. We're not talking about here a criminal activity necessarily. The criminal activities are already covered in the in your criminal statutes. What we're talking about is an alleged violation of ethical standards. 4 years is one long time to leave somebody subject to the possibility of having a complaint filed. First place, it's very difficult, as you're finding out in some of the complaints that have been, some of the allegations have been flying throughout this session. How difficult it is to go back just a few weeks and reconstruct. 4 years is impossible. We suggest that at the most 1 year be substituted, and that's why we suggest that change to that language. It in no way affects the legislative body's ability to go after someone who absolutely tries to keep everything secret and tries to keep it from you. So it doesn't prevent you from going after someone who is trying to prevent discovery, and it also doesn't stop any kind of criminal violation.
Representative Phillips?
Do you know what the rationale was behind that?
No.
Want me to state for the record?
Yes, go ahead, Randy.
Representative Randy Phillips, House District 15. We had discussed that in length. The reason we talked about 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, so on and so forth. Bottom line rationale is that 4 years was the maximum any member of the legislature could serve. And we felt during that term of office that we should be responsible for his actions, either previous or in the future. That's why 4 years was placed.
You're also getting people who might not even be a member of the legislature any longer.
Well, it's a year after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a year after. It just seems to us that we're not talking about a criminal action. We're not talking about someone who has directly tried to subvert the activities of the legislature. We're talking about someone who has gone about his business for 4 years or a year after he's left the legislature. It seems to us if there is an ethical violation and it hasn't come to anyone's attention in that year's period, then we shouldn't continually reopen. There's a time to stop, and we felt that 4 years was just unreasonable.
There's no allegations flying around this session, is there?
I'm just from Anchorage. I have no idea. I don't work for anybody here. Okay, on page 10, line 6 going on, we feel that after looking at this, there is some confusion about what happened. Probably when the amendments were being made on the floor, there was some confusion back and forth. We feel that if a complaint can be initiated by any private person, then why does it require three or more members of the committee? And not only that, but if you look at what the committee consists of, if we're talking about the Senate committee or the House committee, there are only three members on each committee. And each one can receive complaints for the members of that particular body. So if you're requiring them to have three or more, what it means, you have to have unanimous, you have to have a unanimous complaint filed by that subcommittee. And we felt that was ridiculous. If any private person can file a complaint, then it seems to us any member of the committee should be able to file a complaint. And so we would suggest rewriting that so that the complaint may be initiated by any person, not just private person, but any person. And the only time that we would require any more than that, we would suggest, is where we have a complaint that is received within a period of 60 days preceding a state primary or general election. In that case, we believe a majority of the members of that committee, which in the case of three, it would be two, and in the case of a joint committee, it would be obviously four. So that was, we felt that that was confusing and probably was an oversight.
Representative Phillip?
Well, I can't speak for the committee process, which is as proposed by the Senate version, but at least we had the commission, we had a similar setup. The legislature is a moving target for anybody. We're in a huge glass house and not very well protected for people from throwing stones. And that's, it's got to have some substance for a complaint to be lodged. There's a lot of people defending DON. We just had one here the other day accusing us of being communists. Is that a reasonable complaint?
No, but let me just say this, though. We're dealing with this particular piece of legislation that came out of the Senate, and the Senate here has that it may be initiated by one private person. So your POM situation is not addressed here. It seems to us, though, if any private person can do it, then why can't any member of the committee do it? And you already have a setup here that allows them to dismiss complaints where under any reasonable set of circumstances they would dismiss it, and these things are kept confidential, so I really don't see the concern here. And like I said, we do require that a majority of the, again, when I say we require, we do not endorse the idea of having this, but if you are going to have a committee or a commission, we believe that you should at least do this. And here it does require the majority of the committee take part in anything that has to do with anything near a general election or a primary, to avoid the problems that I'm sure the committee, the reform committee, was concerned about. Okay, this really, okay, then on line 15, page 11, we're getting down to some of the ones that caused us the most problems.
We're just getting to those.
Line 15, okay, what it does here, and I'm sure Mr. Representative Coxon would agree with me that you need to set up some sort of time for notice to be given so that we don't have notices being given the day before and having people have to appear in a hearing. So we suggested, and this again is an arbitrary time limit, but we suggested that the committee must give at least a minimum of 10 days notice. It could be 5 days, it could be 15, whatever you choose to make it, but there should be a minimum time frame within which for them to give notice to person accused and also the person who did the complaining. And so that we've suggested 10 days, that is certainly not the end all, whatever number of days you would suggest. And we get now to subsections J and K, and to be honest with you, and that starts on page 12, to be honest with you, both of those, and I think this is something you've got to look at very carefully, they seem to be an absolute conflict. They are very confusing. We have no idea, reading this, exactly what you're talking about. In one place it says the order is confined to this determination. We don't know what determination we're talking about, especially since it immediately says then the order is a public record. And then you go on and say that the decision it can only be made public 30 days after the referral to the legislature. We can't suggest any language to clean this up. We're suggesting to you, before you come out of here, you better clean it up, because it's not clear. We're just members of the public, and if the public can't understand it, I would suggest that you are going to have some problems understanding it, too.
Representative Malone?
Yeah, I'm trying to make sure I understand what you're talking about here. Is each decision of the committee must be accompanied by a written order of the committee determined that a violation of the chapter exists or does not exist. The order is confined to this determination. that probably isn't too confusing, I suppose.
Well, the reason it's confusing, because what we assume they meant is that the order itself will either say a violation exists or does not exist, and then we assume that then they meant that that particular determination would be made public. But then when you go farther on and you read in the section K, they talk about a decision being made public 30 days after the referral to the legislature. We feel that if we're in fact talking about two documents, make sure that the two paragraphs clearly indicate we're talking about two documents. One is the initial determination, yes, this person has committed a conflict, has committed a violation, or no, they have not. And then that the decision itself is non-public until 30 days later. And we assume that's what they were trying to say, but we're not sure. And if that is in fact what you're trying to say, make sure that's clear. One other thing along those lines is that we feel strongly that a 30-day waiting period before it's made public, where that 30 days only runs while the legislature is in session, is extremely subject to political manipulation. We'll give you a quick scenario and then I won't take much more of your time. But you can see that, for example, now you don't have the majority-minority problem that they have in the Senate at this point.
We don't.
Glad somebody was waiting for some comment from me. But in fact, what could happen is that if you had this committee, they could decide, in fact, to, if they had, for example, Representative Bussell, and he's either on the ins or the outs this week. I don't know which it is. But they could decide to hold his until they would issue it so that it would come out just before the end of the session, and they could come out and have their decision just before the end of the session. He would then have to go into to a general election. They could decide that Representative Claxton is on the ins this week, so we'll just hold his until the end of the session, so it's not made public until after the general election. So we would suggest that if the 30-day period is important to you, make it run regardless of whether you're in session or you're not in session. We understand the purpose behind this was to ensure that you actually had a decision from the legislature, but it seems to us you can't have it both ways. The legislature cannot leave something that is this subject to political manipulation in the law, and really gets down to the thing that Free Committee feels strongly about. Ultimately, under the Constitution, it is the legislature that has to determine who is qualified to serve. It is the legislature who must determine who, in fact, has violated your ethical standards. And therefore, we have problems with creation of any kind of commission or committee at all because of the possibility of political manipulation.
And can the whole bill point in that direction, Representative Cox?
I have read J&K now, and I am convinced, although they aren't written very clearly, that there is no conflict. As I read it, there are two decisions. There are two documents.
That's how we read it too.
One is a written order, which says one thing, which is whether the violation exists or does not exist, and that is public immediately. It is accompanied by a decision. The decision must contain a statement of the facts, must become public 30 days later, and can include a finding that the legislator has refused to cooperate. Mm-hmm. So there are two documents. I'm not convinced that the two sections are inconsistent. They're certainly not very clear.
What we would suggest, if in fact that is, and we did, after much reading, we decided that was probably what was meant, then it seems to us that there should be a clear distinction within the same paragraph. We should say something like this order is a public record, and the accompanying decision is not made public until 30 days after the referral or whatever, but to make sure that it's clear that we're talking about two separate documents, because the way it's written, we certainly we're not sure.
Representative Cox?
Well, maybe you know, why is it that the decision is kept confidential?
I have no idea. This
was
not our language.
My question on that is that why on your K there it is 30 days after the committee shall make the decision public, 30 days after the referral. and the person up here where there's apparently no no violation, wants to make them consistent, make them wait 30 days. That's my question.
We had the same question.
Make it public right now. Why wait 30 days?
Why should there be two documents?
Well, again, as I see the scenario, Mr. Chairman, that if there is a decision that no violation exists, then there will be only one document. It'll be a one-line document that says we find there's no violation. If, on the other hand, the finding is that there is a violation or that the person didn't cooperate, then there's a one-line thing that apparently says we do find a violation. That document is released immediately, and there's another document floating around that's confidential. I can just imagine in this legislature the difficulty of dealing with the fact that the details of the finding, not allegations, but the finding, are confidential. Well, I think there's some problem with that, and I'd like to hear, hopefully, from somebody to try to justify why that should be kept
confidential. It looks to me like there's two orders. There is an order that may not be made public if there's a determination there's a violation. There's a distinct sentence change here. The order is confined to this determination. This order is a public record if there is no violation. That's the only one that's public record. There's another document there that if there's a determination that there is something, that order is not subject to public record right then, and then becomes part of the decision or whatever. I don't know.
No, I don't agree. I think that the order, what we're calling the order, can say that there is a violation or that there is not a violation. And in either case, it is a public record.
I think that's arguable.
Yeah. See, that's really what you both have brought up is the concern that we have that this is not written as clearly as it should be. We looked at this for all of one day and put something out to you because we knew you were going to be considering it. There's one other, and we think you should look at it to make sure it's clear. There is one other thing that we feel strongly about also, and that is that we're concerned about intentionally false complaints. We feel that you must have something in this particular bill that punishes people for intentionally or recklessly complaining about someone. You know, for example, the POM that comes in and says so-and-so is a communist. You know, this type of thing should be prevented, and so we suggest that you follow what some other states have done, not all, but a few others, and we have some drafted language that would provide a penalty for false complaints. And
Chairman,
Representative Moore,
if a person is a communist, it would be a violation of their current law. Wouldn't be a violation under this bill, and I couldn't support any legislation. Communists, libertarians, Democrats, Republicans. If they were crooks, I think there's a point.
Yeah, I was not suggesting that. As a matter of fact, our Supreme Court has held that that's in fact a free speech issue, and so I agree with Representative Malone. I was just using that because there had been a POM alleging that in fact all of you were communists, and he was concerned about that and being used as the basis of a complaint. And what I'm saying to you is that if someone did file a complaint that was either false and they knew it was false or it was just absolute reckless disregard of the truth, that they should be subject to a violation under the criminal code. And for that, I only have one copy of it. We did suggest some language, and it would just say penalty for false complaints. Any person who shall knowingly and intentionally or with reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of a complaint file a false complaint with the Ethics Committee shall, upon conviction in a court of competent jurisdiction, be guilty of a misdemeanor. And we'll just leave that with you, and we appreciate the time that you have allowed us. We feel strongly about ethics. It is an important issue. We feel also strongly that we want to see good people come to the legislature. We don't want to see legislative ethics become such an onerous burden on someone that you take good people, and we think the majority of legislators are good people who are trying to do a good job. We don't want to make them so onerous that we really throw the baby with the bathwater out and end up with people who really have no business connection at all. And we think we want to have people down here who have some business connection.
What is your plan? I have a, the testimony's been excellent. I have several questions, but we aren't going to get them today.
Well, we are late right now for another meeting that we're supposed to be in at 3 o'clock.
Caucusing or something?
Caucusing? No, we have resources right next door in St. Miska and I right now. They tell them to make a quorum unless we're there.
Are you?
I'm sure they're just holding.
Going back home? Let me ask just a couple questions quick. Two that are real important to me. First is, there are no penalties in this legislation. I want you to comment on that. Second is, if possible, I'd like to have your comments on the difference between a committee and a commission, which seems to be a crucial issue in this bill.
Okay, first, the penalty idea, if you have to recognize that the criminal provisions have not been affected by this. So that, for example, if Senator Dankworth has been accused in a criminal proceeding, that has not been affected in any way. It's specifically protected. And so we haven't affected any of the criminal penalties. And you basically left yourself wide open for whatever penalty that the legislature should decide to impose. Secondly, the difference between the committee and the commission is very simple. The commission, of course, would have public members. Now, while that's very attractive, and I know that there's a big clamor to put public members on there, and we understand how attractive it is, the thing that you cannot avoid two things. First, you have a constitutional duty to decide who can and cannot be a legislator. That's under the Constitution. It is not up to the public, other than through voting, but they cannot decide what the qualifications once that person is elected. But your second problem is this.
Excuse me, they can. They can through an initiative process.
Absolutely.
The process is available for them to decide that you're doing a bad job at any point in your tenure.
I agree. I misspoke. But there is one other thing, and that is that regardless of how you choose those citizens, unless you go to the jury system, a lottery system, every person you put on that commission would be partisan. I'm partisan. Anyone who tries to tell you they are not a partisan person is not telling the truth, because I guess they do exist. But most of us who would be able to become appointed to that type of situation would have some partisan politics that we have played. And I feel strongly that no matter what you do, putting so-called public members on, it doesn't accomplish anything. Just the same as on the PUC, the so-called consumer members. There are no more consumers than I'm a consumer. We're all consumers. We're all members of the public. I feel the legislature is going to have to bite the bullet. It's going to have to do its own house cleaning. I do not believe that this is the same situation that we have in the Bar Association, which is a totally different issue, because they are not elected members. But I just don't see that it accomplishes anything to put public members on.
I quite frankly feel that way about the whole bill.
Well, again, I appreciate you're allowing me to testify. It's an important issue for us as well as you as citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming down and taking time, Sherry. And you too, Hope D.T. You don't have any quick thing you'd like to bring up?
Now, if you want to let me testify as
sure.
To nepotism really quickly. Okay. This is me as my own private person. I feel strongly about nepotism because I come from a military family where my mother, because my father moved so much, was unable to be employed. I feel strongly that this legislation really only affects women, because whether we like it or not, at this point in our history, the majority of the representatives and senators are male. What it does is it does not allow people who are in fact contributing to their husbands or to their loved ones, or if there's their wives contributing, whatever it is, it does not allow them to be compensated for the very real contribution that they are making. I do not feel that nepotism is a serious problem, and frankly, if somebody is going to hire someone to do nothing, they're going to hire their secretary to do nothing. We have that in Congress. So I feel strongly that nepotism should be that whole part should be struck. And I recognize that does not represent free committee, that represents me. And again, it's because of my feelings about women, and they're always being ignored, and they're never being paid for what they do. And I feel strongly that if a legislator wants to hire his wife or his daughter or his son, he should be able to do that. Who else can he trust better? should we have professional legislative aides, or should you be able to trust someone in your own, should you be able to bring someone into your office that you have absolute trust in and that you know their philosophical bent? So I feel that that section is unnecessary. That's, thank you.
There seems to be a broad implication almost by everybody here that a legislator hires your staff and they are responsible strictly to that legislator and no one else has anything to do with them. But that's just exactly the opposite from my experience. This staff around here has to rub shoulders with everybody, and they are extremely susceptible to a complaint. And if that complaint has any validity to it, the staff has to go, and it wouldn't necessarily come from me, it could come from anybody, and it could find its way to the rules chairman, or to the speaker, or to other members of the leadership, and we, you know, the staff doesn't belong to the legislator. I don't know where everybody gets that idea.
Well, to me, it's a woman's issue, and perhaps I'm wrong. I know that not many people agree with me, but I feel it's a strong women's issue, and I feel that you should drop that out.
My wife agrees with you.
Well, I think there's probably strong feelings for this committee about that too. We spent quite a little time considering a nepotism bill around here, and I guess it found its way back into the drawer.
We're not talking about a state agency that has a real supervisory problem with nepotism. Here we're talking about legislative.